Every dating app swipe is another loss. Gym bros, fake CEOs, straight up losers. So now the only app I open is Modo Casino, because at least there I'm surrounded by winners, real winners, thousands of them. While everyone else is in the single swamp, I'm at home relaxing while stacking bonuses, hitting wins, and playing all my favorite Vegas style games. Modo Casino, the only app worth your time.
Modo Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Modo.us for more details.
Download the Modo Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Modo Casino, America's social casino.
Modo Casino is pure American energy. Born in the USA and with the same 1776 spirit that built this country. Modo, America's social casino, is celebrating that freedom with a 1 million sweeps coin prize giveaway. One lucky American is going to win 1 million sweeps coins. So what are you waiting for? Spin now on Modo Casino.
Download the Modo Casino app today.
Modo Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Modo.us for more details.
Modo Casino, America's social casino.
This is continuing live courtroom coverage of the Take Care of Maya trial from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Okay, members of the jury, I mean, you probably figured out what we were doing. Just trying to figure out timing and lunch. And it probably is best that we don't start. So what that means is, why don't we take lunch now? I'm going to ask that you be back and ready to go, Deputy Coley, at 1 p.m. So about an hour and 35 minutes. So do not discuss this case amongst yourselves. Do not do any investigation and receive no information. Okay, thank you. The jury's out of our presence. Everyone can be seated. Why don't we come back at 12:40, which is an hour and 15 minutes from now. That'll give us 20 minutes to discuss whatever we need to discuss.
Judge, can I raise one quick issue, or do you have to go?
Hopefully it's quick.
Well, Judge, in reviewing the video for Dr. Neuberger, I didn't actually watch the video. I just read what they said was on the video words. I'm not anticipating any exhibits coming up, and I just need to find out, are they going to be flashing pleadings or things during the video? Because I didn't watch it. I took their word that this was what was on the video.
And I saw that in Dr. Smith's, a couple of them, we did cover up whatever was being shown to her at the time.
So. One was a pleading. But in any event, that's my question. Is it just the doctor? Or are they going to be flashing up documents? Because I didn't watch the video. I didn't think that was necessary.
I haven't had time to watch it myself, but I'd suggest, is that solution acceptable, that we cover things that have come up on the screen momentarily? Well, that box quicker?
Well, look, if there's going to be something that is not in evidence, it absolutely needs to be covered.
Sure.
Or somehow not shown to the jury.
Interesting. I've watched part of it and read the transcript.
I've just said what has to happen. I trust that directive is going to be taken care of.
Judge, as to the Sally Smith video, at approximately 111 minutes, 10 seconds, there was a response by Sally Smith, where she said, and we had objected to this, she was responding to a law enforcement request that she conduct an investigation. So that is flat out true, and there's absolutely no evidence in this record that Dr. Smith was ever contacted and assigned by the police department or the sheriff's department or anyone else. And so we would like an instruction that although the question and answer were allowed, there's no evidence in this record that Sally Smith was acting on behalf of the Sarasota County Sheriff's Department or anyone else.
Well, hold on a second. Wasn't the testimony, if she got a referral from the hotline or law enforcement, I think was what the...
It was an alternative.
I don't recall her saying in this particular case that law enforcement requested her.
I will double check the transcript. Maybe I heard incorrectly.
Let's double check, because I think there was an or, and I did not, sitting here, I didn't get the perception that any law enforcement requested her.
We just want to make sure, of course, that the jury doesn't get the idea that she was under there for any particular tasking by the Sheriff's Department, the State Attorney's Office, or anything else. The only other thing at this point we wanted to just start out, we can talk about it later, is that...
If we're going to talk about it later, let's not talk about it now.
Okay.
What time do we need to be back there?
Let's be back at 12:40.
12:40. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now, hold on a second. When I say let's talk about it later, is this some sort of motion that's already been filed that I need to be ready to go on, or is this the issue that was from this morning?
It's an issue that just came up this morning.
That issue was...
But we have not filed a memorandum on it. It came up through the course of Sally Smith's deposition, but I can present the motion as an Ora Tennis motion to conform the pleadings to the proof in this case.
Well, why don't... We'll deal with that one later.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
All rise. This court is at recess.
Miss Crow, you changed sides.
We're working together in a cooperative way.
Conflicts are always.
She knows when to bail.
Not to tell her.
Okay. At some point, I'm going to need the time breakdown between the plaintiffs and the defense for Dr. Smith's depo, but.
Our long-suffering state IT individual did the breakdown. We did share it with opposing counsel. Are you guys okay with the numbers we circulated? The total for Dr. Sally Smith on the plaintiff's side was 35 minutes and 14 seconds. Defense, 22 minutes and 57 seconds.
Okay.
That's pretty precise.
Mr. Whitten.
Yes, Your Honor. I'd just like to ask that we... hopefully have time at the end of today or first thing in the morning. We submitted our exhibit list for the day. We've withdrawn some of them. I've spoken with Ms. Crawls about it, and we'd like to get this done.
Well, let's first follow up on
Understood.
Any motion, if any, that is coming from this morning's activities.
Yes, Your Honor. We went back and reviewed the testimony of Sally Smith that we directed the court to this morning, and there was some concern on our part that the phrasing of
Time out. Are you moving for a mistrial or not? Let's deal with that issue first.
Well, the question that my appellate counsel asked is whether this court... upon moving for a mistrial, is open to a motion to defer a ruling until the end of the case.
And as I told you earlier, I'm not inclined in making an advisory opinion on a hypothetical motion.
All right. At this time, then, we would not be able to move for a mistrial, though we think it's warranted.
So, to be clear, you are not moving for a mistrial?
At this point.
And are you seeking any type of relief, if any, at this point?
We follow the court's initial thoughts on this, that any additional instruction in that regard would likely simply emphasize the testimony and cause additional harm. We do not believe that the harm can be cured by virtue of an instruction that the jury is now... been, I have to use the word tainted by a question and answer, which we found, given the court's repeated orders and instructions to counsel, completely inappropriate, and given the fact that it was given after several days, could not have been just simply an error on the fly. And so, but we do not think that a further curative instruction would, we think it may do more harm than good at this point. But if the court has an idea on that, we're always open to it.
I operate based on someone filing a motion or orally moving, right? So I'm not hearing a motion, so
I don't think so, Judge. I think not at this point.
Okay. Anything else on that subject before we move on to the next subject?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Altenberg, you stood up and walked this way. I didn't know if it was for this or for something else.
When he brought up topic two as topic one, I thought he was probably getting to topic two.
Okay.
I've just seen this on a text message. So
let's move on to the next issue. So what's the next issue, Mr. Anderson?
During the course of the testimony of Sally Smith, we pointed out at approximately 111 minutes and 10 seconds, there was a question and response in which there was an objection by the plaintiffs, which the court overruled as to Sally Smith's response of her investigation being instigated, begun by law enforcement, and I believe the court said, thought it read, or state agency, and in fact it says, and, leaving the impression within the jury, and I can read it into the record as necessary.
Mr. Anderson, do you mind telling us the depth of the impeachment?
Yeah, sure. Let's see, it's
240.
It's Sally Smith deposition from January 8th, 2022.
January 18th.
January 18th, 2022 at page 111.
I believe in the
thank you.
Response here. I can't. There it is. All right. And in context, it says, what do you mean by that? And it says, well, in order, my job in this case was to respond to the request from the investigators and law enforcement as to whether there was medical evidence of child abuse or neglect in this case. And the only way to do that when the concern is Munchausen by proxy or medical child abuse is to gather extensive medical records, such as one can review all of those medical records and put that in the context of information that may be directly obtained from such information as I got directly from Beata. Ordinarily, one would consider one's physical exam, but in this case, I was unable to conduct a physical exam on the child and then put all that information together to try to determine whether there's medical evidence of the child of child abuse. And then, so if on October 11th, 12th, when I, or 13th, I spoke to Dr. Kirkpatrick, if I had just said, oh, Dr. Kirkpatrick, there's no Munchausen by syndrome by proxy here, so there must not be, I would not have be doing my job. We objected to that because in the context of the answer, it leaves the impression, the distinct impression by the jurors that Sally Smith's initiation of it, and particularly we're talking about October 8th, and the context of this, and the jury is well aware of our arguments as to October 8th, but that Sally Smith's initiation of her investigation was at the behest of law enforcement and investigators, let's see, investigators and law enforcement. And so, if it was or, that might be a different story, but since it's and, we believe that a curative instruction is appropriate. We have one, if I could approach. And it's on the email, we can email it up to
I can put it on the screen, Your Honor.
So
you can
turn you put it on the screen, but hand me the sheet of paper.
I just need the screens turned off.
Not very fancy, but.
Can I see the, can you hand me the run report or the deposition pages?
Give me yours. Here's his client. Here you go.
It's January 18th.
At the bottom of the first page, Judge.
2014?
What says the defense?
Well, first of all, I'm really not sure I see exactly where the confusion is. In order to do my job in this case, to respond to the requests of the investigator and law enforcement. Okay. So statutorily, when a hotline report comes in, it goes to both DCF and to normally the local sheriff's by statute. And she will get assigned by DCF. But law enforcement will also do its own investigation, which I presume is where this deputy came from in this case. So if law enforcement contacts her in its investigation as an agent of DCF, she probably does coordinate with them and can coordinate with them. Under 39303 subpart 3, the CPT team has a lot of different things they can do. They can consult and provide advice to the doctors in this case and the CPT team that you many other things. So I'm not so sure that this is saying anything that she doesn't do or isn't authorized to do. The instruction they have is saying that there's some implication here. I don't know that we need to give a curative instruction on an implication. And if we do, we always explain that she was appointed to do this on whatever day it was by DCF, and that Sunshine was doing this as an agent of DCF.
Well, I think the problem with that is, didn't she get called from the hospital ahead of time and started looking ahead of time before?
She got contacted by the hospital ahead of time. She did.
October 8th, and began reviewing that. And this, and if it hadn't said my job in this case, if she was talking generally, I would agree, and it said, or I agree with the court, you know. But in this case, where she says, it's my job in this case, and one of the key issues is, when did she begin that job? Then it leaves the jury with the idea that everything Sally Smith did, even October 8th, was at the instigation of investigators and law enforcement. And if the jury believes that all these things she did were at the direction of law enforcement, which they directly were not, then that is extremely prejudicial. The jury will place, as we've seen time and time again, tremendous weight on the statements and actions of law enforcement. And we cannot have, from the plaintiff's point of view, we request the court's assistance, the jury believing that law enforcement in this early stage was involved. The facts are the only involvement came much later, and there was never an actual case filed by the state attorney. There was simply a detective. Well, she was a detective briefly, who then questioned Jack Kowalski, and the court's familiar with those facts. But insofar as a formal investigation opened up by law enforcement, one detective does not make an investigation go. Regardless of those facts, the main problem is right now that jury thinks that law enforcement had given some right for Sally Smith, or demand more troublingly, had compelled or ordered Sally Smith to initiate an investigation. And that's tremendously, tremendously harmful for us.
The issue is what she did on one day. I'm not exactly certain the exact moment that she was assigned by DCF to begin that investigation. The simplest thing would be to do that her investigation for DCF began specifically on that date. Now, I will tell you that the statute that gives the CPT authority to do things includes being able to consult and advise with doctors, and I don't read that necessarily as only after I have been assigned to do an investigation. Because, I mean, what she's explaining here is that people call her more or less to get advice on whether there's medical abuse so that they need to make a report. And so I don't know that from reading that statute that she's prohibited from giving advice in her capacity as the head of the CPT team as to whether or not a doctor's getting close enough to the mark that they need to turn in a formal report to do that.
Well, I
think this instruction, as prepared at least, is much broader than it needs to be.
Well, how about something along these lines? During the course of the testimony of Sally Smith, MD, she made a statement that implied that her involvement was instigated by law enforcement. The court instructs you to disregard this question and answer. There is no evidence in this case that Sally Smith, MD, began her involvement at the request of law enforcement.
I have no objection to that instruction.
Here's my notes, so if anyone wants to look at it.
The question
to the extent she's worried about it implies that they lied.
Yeah, Judge, the issue I have with the instruction is that when you say she implied something, it makes it sound like she deliberately misled. And so my issue is with that language in the instruction. There's no indication that she was deliberately trying to mislead anybody with that answer. She gave a long answer to a question. And so that's my issue with this.
Well, she probably did respond to questions from law enforcement here. And that's quite likely to happen.
Can we just correct the fact without saying she, you know, implied this, but it's not true?
How about made a statement that may be construed?
Well, Judge, I don't think that it matters what her internal thoughts were at this time. The fact is the words that she said implied that. And I think the term implied is the best term for that situation. I don't think it should be watered down because I'm not worried about what's going on in Sally Smith's head here. I am worried about the implications of her actual statement on the jury.
Can we say just referenced during the course of the testimony of Sally Smith, she made a statement that referenced law enforcement? The court instructs you to disregard this. There's no evidence. That doesn't, because implied also implies conscious attempt to mislead. That's my education with the word implied.
Statement that implied. I didn't say Sally Smith implied. I said a statement that implied.
And
that's the point of this. And I would move the court to enter it as the court had redrafted it the first time.
And Ms. Crowell, what wording did you say?
I was going to say referenced. She made a statement that referenced law enforcement. And then as you go on, you correct it. You say there is no evidence that law enforcement initiated the call or however you have it on your statement. Yeah.
I still do not believe that will do the job on something as powerful as this. If that jury comes away from this in any way thinking that law enforcement sent Sally Smith over there, that implies that law enforcement already had sufficient reason to engage and send an investigator over. It imbues her with much greater power and authority, and it strikes the heart of whether the jury believes that all of this was warranted or unwarranted, and that is an issue in the case.
Well, from a factual standpoint, and I'm correct on this, and I think both sides will agree, but if I'm not, Sally Smith's involvement in this case began when a doctor at Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital called her up or texted her or contacted her. And so she went in and started it that way. It was not based on a call to the hotline. It was not based at the request of any law enforcement agency.
That's true.
Information about whether this was child abuse as compared to kind of treatment.
But I don't think she can.
This is at the core of this problem. There was, and we now have the specific times that were involved, and we know that the initial call was washed out at some point in the late evening of the 7th, and then we know that the next call for an investigation came in approximately 2 or 2:40. The time 2:40 p.m. comes to my mind on the 9th. During the 8th, there is no evidence whatsoever of any agency or any law enforcement or anyone in authority telling Sally Smith she should go do this. The evidence, overwhelming evidence, I think uncontradicted evidence, is that somebody at Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital called her and asked her to start doing an investigation. And that is flat, plain wrong.
That's not true, Your Honor. The call was made by Dr. Beatrice Pepper Sanchez on the 8th. There was testimony to ask them why that call was made. The second call was accepted on October 9th. The testimony that is at issue here was a follow-up question about a conversation that Sally Smith had with Dr. Kirkpatrick that absolutely took place well after the second hotline call was accepted on October 9th, 2016.
No, the point is that it was not accepted until, and if it's the ninth, fine. The point is, at the time she was doing all these investigations, she had no authority from the state to do so. There was no...
Folks, as a reminder, whoever speaks last doesn't win. That's not how I operate. I'm just rereading... The question, I just want to be fair in this situation when it comes to what Dr. Smith actually said to the question that was asked. Now, instead of using the word implied, I think I'm going to go with maybe construed. So during the course of Sally Smith, MD, or during the course of the testimony of Sally Smith, MD, she made a statement that may be construed that her involvement was instigated by law enforcement. The court instructs you to disregard this question and answer. There is no evidence in this case that Sally Smith, MD, began her involvement at the request of law enforcement.
Okay. Agreed by the plaintiff.
Okay. So I will give that as soon as the jury comes back in. Are there other issues we need to address?
For the record, Judge, we had moved to conform the pleadings to the proof insofar as the allegations of agency in our complaint. It is at paragraph 14, page 6 of the 8th amended complaint. Right now, their issue before the court is apparent agency, and based on the testimony of Sally Smith, which the party agreed, the defendant agreed to, a lot of evidence now has come in as to general agency based on the different committees she was on, her role there, and what she did in terms of the patient. And so what I want to be able to do is, and I'm not sure if amendment to conform is the correct way or not, and I'm not sure maybe it's relief from a prior order, but I wanted to preserve for the record the ability to request at the end a jury instruction on general agency as well as apparent agency, because now, based on that testimony, the issue is much broader.
So I don't understand what you're asking me to do.
Well, I'm noting it for the record, and so that's the first thing. So the court doesn't have to do anything right now. We would be filing a motion for the appropriate relief, but it's necessary for me to timely state that on the record, why we believed and what we intend to do that way.
Anybody on the defense want to
say? I haven't seen a motion on this, but you already granted a summary judgment based on all of this stuff that was given to you once before and determined there was no agency. She's a member as a staff physician, not an employee, on a number of committees that the physicians are on to self-regulate them because they're self-regulated even when they're in a hospital. That doesn't make her an agent of the hospital. And he wants to put this evidence in to try to show a tie, but we're going to have some instruction that we've already got into my proposal, at least explaining what a staff attorney who has staff privilege, excuse me, what a physician who has staff privilege is as compared to an employee. So I don't think this changes anything, and we certainly weren't trying anything by consent by allowing this stuff to be plowed one more time.
Well, it doesn't sound like there's a motion in front of me to do anything at this point, so I'm not doing anything unless I get a motion.
Yes, sir.
Anything else before we bring the jury back in? Who's going to be reading Dr. Neuberger?
I guess I'm Dr. Neuberger. We were going to hire an actor. We couldn't find one. I can't. I'm trying to figure out who to...
Judge, I would just ask, as you're reading it, when you're going to skip like 20, 30 pages, if you can just say the next page, yeah. So I don't have to try to find where you're
at. And are we reading both their designations and your designations together?
I can.
There's not very many of our designations, Judge, so I'm assuming you marked them on in your deck.
Whatever the rulings were, we marked them all here. I don't know whose or whose at this point.
Yeah.
But we're reading it all.
There's I would say, a total of two pages combined of our designations.
And so I'm to tell the jury that Dr. Neuberger is medically unavailable to come live, and he has three depositions. The first two were not videoed, so the lawyers are going to read, and they're going to read everybody's designations. The third deposition will be by video, and I'll get the chance to turn off the lights again.
Yes. Since you've practiced and did so well.
Yes, but that was hours ago.
I'll be well asleep by
then. Okay, let's bring in.
And Mr. Hunter had to go do some case-related things. He'll be in later. Sorry, I didn't want
That's
to
fine.
Think he was.
Let's bring in the jury. Witnesses tomorrow.
I believe we provided the only change.
Once again, all rise.
Okay. Okay, please be seated. Members of the jury, when I say I'm trying to keep you on your toes, I mean, I was kind of being figurative. I want to confirm while we're away, you did not discuss this case amongst yourselves. You did no investigation and received no information. Is that all correct? And has anyone approached you about this case? And have anyone seen any media coverage about this case?
No.
Okay. Let me just ask, is everyone okay and ready to proceed?
Good.
Okay. I wasn't singling anyone out. Okay. I'm going to give you an instruction before we call the next witness. During the course of the testimony of Sally Smith, MD, she made a statement that may be construed that her involvement was instigated by law enforcement. The court instructs you to disregard this question and answer. There is no evidence in this case that Sally Smith, MD, began her involvement at the request of law enforcement. Okay, next issue. We're going to have another deposition for you. This doctor is medically unavailable to be with us for this trial. So we're going to... do his deposition. Now, he has been deposed three different times. The first two times, there was no video.
So the parties are going to read, I think some of the attorneys are going to read the portions that both sides have designated from those first two depositions. The third deposition was done by video, and we will then play the third deposition's video. So with that, we'll call your next witness, Mr. Anderson.
Me as Eli Neuberger.
Okay, now, so the role that Mr. Anderson is playing is Dr. Neuberger, okay? And then Mr. Whitney will be the role of the attorney, regardless of which attorney asked the question. So it's just easier to do it this way.
All right, beginning at page 5, line 20.
I'm sorry, can you state the date of the deposition, please?
First deposition is dated September 22nd, 2020. And beginning at page 5, line 20, I'll just read in, Eli Herbert Neuberger, MD, the witness herein, having been first duly sworn, was examined and testified as follows. Turning to page 6, beginning at line 2, would you please state your full name for the record?
Yes, it's Eli Herbert Neuberger.
And fair to call you Dr. Neuberger as we proceed today?
Yes.
All right, Dr. Neuberger, what is your profession?
I'm a pediatrician.
And do you maintain active licenses?
I do.
Do you have active licenses in more than one state?
No.
What state do you maintain active licenses in?
Massachusetts.
Okay. Have you ever practiced medicine as a pediatrician in any other states?
No.
Okay. I have your, can I get your professional address, sir?
Sure, it's 132, and then there are three words, lime, as in the fruit, kiln, K-I-L-N, as in the oven, road. The town is Lenox, L-E-N-O-X, Massachusetts, 01240.
And is that an office, doctor?
That's my home. As you can see, I'm at my home office.
Okay, and do you have a brick-and-mortar office outside the home?
I don't.
Okay. Have you had a brick-and-mortar office outside of the home any time in the last 5 to 7 years?
No.
Okay. What is the nature of your – well, strike that. You're a pediatrician. Do you have any specialties or subspecialties within or under the branch of a pediatrician?
Yes. First, I'm a general pediatrician with a long history of serving as a hospital pediatrician. I'm as well a specialist in developmental and behavioral pediatrics and child abuse pediatrics.
Okay. And can you break down your professional practice for me? Do you have a clinical practice as a pediatrician?
Well, yes, but with certain specific boundaries. So after many years of service on the staff of Boston's Children's Hospital and my teaching at Harvard Medical School, my wife and I moved to Lenox, Massachusetts. I readjusted my life and schedule and no longer teach at Harvard Medical School, but rather to continue, but on a smaller level, my national consulting practice on both behavioral and developmental issues and on rare pediatric illnesses. So I have a national consulting practice that brings to my attention cases that require a high level of differential diagnosis, expertise, and case analysis. A certain number of cases like this one also come over the transom. I don't advertise, but people, by dint of my publications, by dint of my reputation, often ask me to consult in regard to child custody matters, in regard occasionally to the prosecution or defense in criminal matters, and in cases like this, where child abuse diagnosis and missed diagnosis are at issue.
Turning to page 9, line 4, I think... Your answer continues.
So as a consequence, I receive no few referrals, say, from defense counsel, from people like yourselves, Mr. Haskell, who may have a complex case to defend. So then I will conduct a review. And I do this especially in Massachusetts because there are few physicians like me with the depth of experience in this area. And then I will spend a few hours and then give them my unvarnished views, even if I decide not to accept the case.
Okay. If I can interject, doctor, let me just go ahead and make sure I understand some of what you just told me. you, in terms of actually providing care to children as a practicing clinical pediatrician, when was the last time you did that?
Well, I periodically will examine children in the setting of my specialty consultation. I don't have an office practice. After December 31st, 1999, when I closed my office at Boston's Children's Hospital, I was no longer the director of the clinic in which I saw children, but did a small amount of primary care, but I never had a pediatric practice. I do, in this work, occasionally conduct examinations of children and incorporate those into my reports. So I'm a licensed, board-certified skills as a pediatrician, but that's relatively infrequent. I don't examine more than one child a month, I would say.
Okay. At that rate, if you were to examine one child a month, and in that context of examining, say, one child a month, when was the last time you entered an order or actually authored a consultation or a progress note in relation to your care or examination of a child?
I don't understand what you mean by an order.
Sure. All right. So as I understand it, if there is an examination of a child at a rate of maybe one time a month, as you described.
Yes.
You do so in the context as a consultant, correct?
Yes.
Okay. When was the last time, if at all, you ever served as an actual treating physician outside the context of a consultant?
I can't recall a recent case other than the diagnosis of pneumonia in one of my grandchildren, and then referred that child, after I listened to her chest, to her own pediatrician.
Understood. And would it be fair to say then you were kind of doing that out of the love and affection of your grandchild, and based upon what you believe might be the case, you referred her out to for formal treatment?
Well and beautifully said, Mr. Haskell.
All right. I appreciate that. Okay. So with that understanding and with what you just described, doctor, would it be fair to say then it's been at least 10 years that you've last provided any type of actual clinical treatment to a child as a pediatrician?
Answer, I think that's fair to say.
And turning to the bottom of the page. Dr. Sally Smith served and serves as the medical director for the Child Protection Team for Pinellas County here in Florida. You're aware of that?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Have you served in that capacity or a similar capacity in the last, let's say, 10 years from a formal standpoint?
No.
And to the bottom of the page, your current profession, if you will, all of your work from a professional standpoint at the current time is essentially consulting type work in cases like this or criminal cases. Is that fair?
No.
Okay. How am I wrong there?
Well, because I get consulted on a variety of matters that have to do with child behavior, attention deficit disorder and its diagnosis, autism and its diagnosis, and I published a book, now 20 years old, on boys' character development, and it's a well-received book that's still in print, and I often get asked about behavioral problems involving boys. I lecture and consult. Well, I used to lecture before the COVID-19 disaster hit. So many cases that I come across the transit here actually involve serious behavioral issues in which I am competent to opine.
And I appreciate that. So if you could describe for me, or better explain so I understand, in a context or a scenario where you were consulted about ADD or behavioral issues, as you just described, how is it that, can you explain for me how you become involved? And I guess a better way to go about this is, how would you bill for your services?
Well, in very many cases, I charge minimal amounts of money, and in very many of them, I do this pro bono. I see that as part of my obligation of someone who supports strengthening the character of boys. So in those situations, when people write to me on various issues, I'd give them some guidance. Only rarely will I actually conduct a formal interview, much less a clinical evaluation of a child, but I get lots of calls of that kind. I don't charge for them. In the case consultations, however, to get to your question, I charge $450 an hour for my time as a consultant. And those consultations generally involve extensive record reviews, typically involving complex pediatric issues. And they come to me from individuals. They come to me occasionally from attorneys. On occasion, they have to do with complexities of diagnosis and treatment, needs and setting of custody conflict. So I'm consulting often, for example, by child protection agencies, by state offices that are facing vexing diagnostic issues, and then they'll issue a contract for a short amount of service.
Okay. So I'm clear. And do you have your CV in front of you, doctor?
I don't, but I know it, and I can pull it up if you need it.
Okay, I'll address that in just a moment. But the $450 an hour, I note that in the materials, I understand you've either reviewed and or generated. In this case, or as it relates to this case, I know I received an invoice for your time here today, as you describe it, $450 an hour. And I'm just pulling it up here.
Yes, correct.
Okay. And is that how, so you just talked about the consulting work that you do. And some of it's pro bono, as you've described, and some of it involves a cumbersome review of records and materials, et cetera, like this case. You charge $450 an hour for that kind of work. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. And between that dichotomy, if you will, consulting work where you might do it pro bono, or consulting work where you might charge for your time, like you are in this case, does that make up that dichotomy, the full aspect, the full scope of your profession as it stands today?
Well, not exactly. Because I also have a profession of giving lectures in areas that I have expertise. If it's my income that I derive from these various sources. I also have another profession, and that is somewhat represented on my CV as a musician and a writer of music. So I've had, all through my professional career and prior to my professional career, a lively interest in performing classical music and jazz.
Page 19, line 10. Okay, doctor. So then let me make sure I have like some bookends on this, or at least I understand the parameters. Setting aside, if you're offering something, setting aside for giving a lecture or presentation, setting aside what you might do by way of the musical endeavors that you've described, your profession as it relates to the medical side of things, is broken up into those two categories that I've talked about, either pro bono type of consulting work or retained type consulting work where you're paid an hourly rate. Is
correct.
That fair?
Correct.
Okay, what percentage of your overall current income is derived from doing the expert consulting work versus the other work you described?
It's under 20%.
Okay, and then that under 20% amount, can you break that down further as to, I guess this is a bad question I'm about to say, because you told me there's a dichotomy there as far as the medical consulting work goes. Part of it's pro bono, and the other part you actually are retained and paid for. So you're telling me that the retained and paid for amount is under 20%.
Yes, of my overall income, correct.
Okay. And when you do the work that you do as an expert consultant, as you are in this case, is $450 an hour the rate that you use no matter what you're doing?
Yes.
Okay. But there's one additional proviso.
That's an answer.
Oh, excuse me.
Yeah.
I say okay, and then you answer again. Mike.
Sorry. Yes.
Okay.
But there's one additional proviso, which of course doesn't pertain right now, and it's this. If I have to be out of town for more than 10 hours, I charge $7,500 a day plus expenses. So occasionally, if I have to be involved in a complex consultation elsewhere that involves travel, etc., I charge that rate as well. But the overall percentage of this income is still under 20% of my total income.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to turn a little bit now. We covered some of this stuff on your CV already, but I'm going to, if you'd like to pull it up, in case you need to reference it, but I have it in front of me.
Sure.
As far as, and I'm obviously, although I'm interested in your musical career, I'm going to pay attention today as to the medical side of things and the expert consulting things. So in that 20% or so of your overall income and work, if you will, it's all, is there anything on your CV where you actively participate in any appointments or in any hospital affiliations or anything like that at the current time? As far as the medical consulting goes, or the medical, anything you do medically?
No. I was on various governing boards of nonprofits, some of which had to do with agencies that are actually delivered care. I'm not doing that now. Since we moved to Lenox full-time 2 years ago, I happily retired and from all of the nonprofit services. And I have, at the moment, no hospital appointments or responsibilities, nor teaching responsibilities at a medical school.
Well, let's do it this way, because I think it's best to do it by way of almost exclusion. When was the last time that you, let's start with, maintained any position with a hospital board or with a hospital committee of any kind?
Well, my appointments at Children's Hospital and Harvard Medical School expired in 2019 when we moved to Lenox, and I could no longer teach at those institutions. Simultaneously with that move, I withdrew from the governing board of Planned Parenthood of Massachusetts and perhaps one or two other boards that I can't remember. As you can see from my CV over the years, a trustee of many educational institutions and nonprofits. I don't do that anymore.
Okay. And then as far as any involvement, if at all, with child protection teams, or I think up there it might be called child protection services. When was the last time you held any formal positions affiliated with programs like that in the Boston area or Massachusetts?
That was at the end of 1999 when I closed my office at Children's Hospital. And at that point, my formal association with child protection programs ceased.
Turning page 24. Okay. I did see some correspondence between you and Mr. Whitney and or some other folks, possibly at Mr. Anderson's office, plaintiff's counsel's office in this case, regarding some type of license that's set to expire in Florida in October this year. Are you aware of that?
Yes.
What is that license?
Well, in order to be compensated for my service as an expert in a capital murder case in Miami, where I'm designated as a prosecution expert, I have had to obtain some type of certificate that enables me to be identified as a physician.
Turning to page 29, line 13. Okay. And is there an average number per year, let's say, for the last 5, 7 years, whatever, somewhere in that range, that you could provide me that would kind of delineate, you know, again, an average number in which you're retained to provide expert witness testimony in this case, or opinions, I should say?
I could probably find that out for you, but I can tell you that it is not many. So as you can see from this list, relatively few cases actually come to either deposition or trial testimony. The others really have to do with analysis and discussion and conversations. I think that in sum, there are fewer than 15 a year, and that's inclusive of the defense counsel who called me because there's a real shortage of people with my abilities and experience in, you know, cases of shaken baby syndrome or of child sexual abuse where they need someone to review other professionals' opinions. The number is small.
All right, turning to page 35, line 8. Have you ever been retained to provide an opinion, an expert opinion, in a case in which the issues centered on a child abuse investigation based upon reasonable suspicion of child abuse, kind of like what we have here in this case?
Yes.
Let me finish my question. Have you ever provided testimony in a civil case similar to the one we have here today?
Yes.
Okay. When was the last one that you can think of?
This was in July of this year when I was retained by an attorney in Burlington, Vermont, who had been representing the parents of a child with a long-standing complex disorder involving a genetic syndrome and elements of cyclical vomiting, which resulted in weight loss, severe joint pain associated with a congenital syndrome, a tissue disorder in which the family had received extensive diagnostic workups and continuing services in a fine university hospital in New York City prior to moving to Vermont. The child needed urgent care in a hospital in Vermont where the doctors questioned whether this whole history was real or whether it had been invented, fabricated by the mother seeking care for a rare diagnosis that she cooked up in her head. I reviewed extensive materials, consulted extensively with this attorney, and fortunately, prior to the possibility that I might testify in court hearing, the case was dismissed in the local court. So that's another case in which I've been involved. I can give you the attorney's name if that's of interest, but it didn't culminate in any eventual trial testimony.
Turning to page 39, line 8. Okay. All right. Have you, other than the case that you just mentioned in Vermont, have you in the last 5, or let's go back 10 years, have you ever been retained in a case in which you were asked to review the circumstances of suspected child abuse and the ultimate process by which the child abuse investigation occurred? Other than the one you just described.
There have been other cases like that.
Turning page 41, line 14. And doctor, with regard to that board certification, that subspecialty of child abuse pediatrics, do you hold that board certification?
No, I chose not to. First, I was grandfathered in. I am an emeritus member of the Ray Heffler Society, which is a peer reference group of board certified child abuse pediatricians. But much of their examination was founded on my publications and work and materials that I generated for the American Academy of Pediatrics Continuing Education, where I taught a great deal over the decades. But I'm not identified as a child abuse pediatrician, except for the fact that this is a specialty area of mine.
Sure.
And I've dealt with that work.
Understood. And I understand your background, you know. It goes far back, like you said, even before the board certification arose itself, the designation. Let me ask you this. We've already established that your direct involvement in child abuse pediatrics from a hands-on standpoint ended in 1999, correct?
No, not at all. My involvement in child abuse pediatrics has sustained me since I closed my office at Children's Hospital in 1999. In other words, I've had an active consultation practice in this very area and have been consulting continuously both in cases where serious child abuse has occurred and sometimes giving testimony on those issues after my diligent initial reviews. And so I'm continuously involved and I have, how to put it, an eye on the field as it's evolved.
Sure, sure.
I participate on the lists of board-certified child abuse pediatricians, occasionally making a contribution of my own, getting calls from pediatricians around the country around particular cases in which they ask me to consult. I'm quite active in this area.
And I didn't mean to. I mean, what I meant, doctor, and I apologize if I wasn't clear, because it was a poor question, I think. You have not formally served in an investigatory role as far as child abuse pediatrics goes, hands-on, in the trenches, investigating child abuse as it's happening, if you will. Since 1999, you've maintained a consulting practice in this area, but it's been after the fact, so to speak, correct? You're being asked to opine afterwards?
No, that's not true.
Okay.
No, few of the cases in which I've consulted involve cases in process in hospitals as they are going on, and where someone feels that there's a need for an additional consultation with someone with my depth of understanding of these issues.
Turning to page 50, line 6. Okay, doctor, I'm going to shift gears because I want to kind of move on a little bit. I might come back to some of this, but I don't. We only have a certain amount of time today, and I'd like to cover as much as we can. Very, very quickly, just by way of your background, training, and experience as a pediatrician, I'm going to ask you some general questions, and they almost might be silly, they're so general, but I want to make sure I have your understanding on it. You obviously completed medical school, and in the medical school, you received general medical training, correct?
Yes.
And then you chose to move on to become a pediatrician, which is a specialty of medicine, if you will, correct?
Not exactly. When I was in medical school, one had to, prior to graduating from medical school, choose a path in subsequent training, both what you would do an internship in, and then, if so desired, what area of practice, family medicine, or one of the subspecialties you wanted to go into. I had accepted a neurology residency at Stanford in California, but in 1966, the year in which I graduated, during the Lyndon Johnson administration, as troop levels in Vietnam rose to over 1.5 million, there was a shortage of doctors to support the war effort. And they imposed at that time a doctor draft in which all male graduates of the class of 1966, my graduating class, were obliged to register with their draft boards and to choose service in one of the uniformed services.
And so I'm clear. My question is being a pediatrician a specialty in the field of medicine?
Yes.
Okay. And so doctors like you, and I noticed you might have taken a different path as to how and why you got there versus some other folks. But you received separate training as a pediatrician than some folks that graduate medical school and choose a different specialty. Is that right?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Sure.
I mean, if you want to become a pediatrician, you have to...
Yes, please go ahead. What is it about being a pediatrician that is specific to that specialty?
Well, pediatricians have an obligation and a formation in the understanding of the path of physiology of infants and child illness and its prevention and treatments. This requires rigorous course of training in which they, under the guidance of senior physicians, senior themselves, actually give care to children in inpatient and outpatient settings. That's called an internship and a residency. And typically, this goes forth in the setting of a medical school department of pediatrics that lasts for a certain number of years. And then for most pediatricians, it culminates in a short subsequent experience and then the taking of board examination, which covers their knowledge and understanding of the field. And then they become certified as specialists.
So they receive separate and additional, if you will, training about the care and treatment evaluation of a child versus the adult population?
Essentially, yes.
Okay. And you yourself, and I don't want to rehash things here, but you have not maintained a clinical practice as a general pediatrician in any form or fashion since 1994. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. All right, doctor. Have you ever served as a statewide medical director of a child protection service?
No.
Turning to page 54. Okay. And as you mentioned, you have taught some here in Florida. And I think you just mentioned you've actually taught on the subject of Munchausen syndrome by proxy.
Yes.
Turning to page 57, line 1. Doctor, but I was looking for a number. How many times have you lectured or taught on that subject in the state of Florida?
Well, I think there was something like 4 or 5 different presentations. And I seem to recall they occurred in different places because they drew the teams together from different places.
Okay. And so approximately, again, and it's an estimation, but 4 to 5 times you've taught or lectured on that subject in the state of Florida throughout your career.
That's my memory.
Okay. And the 4 or 5 times that it occurred subsequent to the explanation or story you just provided about that one particular case, when was that case? What time frame?
If memory serves, I was first contacted by a lawyer for a hospital that was sued by this mother, alleging that nurses in the hospital had sent vomitus from the child to the laboratory without her permission.
I'm looking for a year. Do you know what year it was?
As I said, I believe it was 1991.
Page 59, line 23. So you believe it to be a legitimate condition?
Yes, but it's a diagnostic wastebasket.
Page 61, line 13. I do want to hone in on one word you just used, doctor, because it was one I was about to throw out to you, and you used it. I understand you called at the start a diagnostic wastebasket, the condition itself. But fair to say, and I think you yourself just used the word, the condition often presents itself on a spectrum that requires evaluation. Is that fair?
Exactly, exactly.
Page 63, line 22. I'll call this essentially your scope of retention in your matter. When were you first retained by Mr. Anderson's firm in this case?
Bear with me. Sure. This was in June of 2020.
Okay. And then, you know, I show other materials sent to you, continuing through February to March, June, July, August, and even September of this year. Does that sound right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And I also show that sometime, I think relatively recently, you submitted an invoice for a total of about 72.5 hours for your time incurred thus far?
Yes.
Is that the sum total, setting aside what you're doing here today, is that the sum total of the time that you've spent on this case?
Bear with me for a moment. I believe that that is the time. On hold for just a moment. I want to be absolutely sure I'm giving you an accurate response.
Sure, and I appreciate that.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And then what did you do in preparation for your deposition today, if anything?
I reviewed numerous documents pertaining to the practice of Dr. Sally Smith, her deposition, and then numerous other hospital reports, records, the reports of psychologists, Dr. Lewis, Dr. Duncan, the records of Eagle's Wings, where the family sought psychiatric consultation, the deposition transcripts of the primary care physician, Dr. Wassenauer.
All right, turn to page 105, line 6. All right, doctor, I'm going to shift gears so I can get into some of the actual opinions here and get into what it is you reviewed and what your opinions are based on what you reviewed. Let me ask you this real quick, though. So before I make that seg, the medical records that are listed in paragraphs 5A through P, the medical records, the hospital records, things like that, those are the records that you've reviewed. I mean, I looked at them, and they totaled maybe 100-something, 200 pages tops. Does that sound about right in terms of the records themselves?
No, I think that's an underestimate. I think it's much more like 500 pages.
Okay. But if I were to represent to you that the medical record or medical chart from Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital is thousands of pages, you haven't reviewed thousands of pages, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And by way of deposition transcripts, of course, you've talked about Dr. Sally Smith. You've reviewed those. You've reviewed Dr. Wassenaar's. You reviewed Dr. Diaz. But that's it. Is that right?
Hold on for a moment. Correct.
Okay. All right, doctor. If I could ask you then, I'm going to walk through your deposition in a few moments here. But if I could just first start with you, if you could just kind of, and I know some of this is going to be covered in your affidavit, and you'll expound on that, I imagine. But can you give me kind of broad stroke, maybe bullet point fashion, what your opinions are here in this case, what you are prepared to offer in front of a jury? And what I'm asking for is, I don't need a dissertation at this moment. If you could just really, in a few sentences, and we'll go into more detail in each one, But just so I have a roadmap, what your broad stroke opinions are in this case.
Sure, I'll try. First, and these are within the bounds of medical and scientific certainty, that her medical approach in this case diverged from the accepted standard of care, accepted standard of the hospital treating physicians conducting an appropriate differential diagnosis in which all alternatives are seriously considered and honestly represented.
Okay.
Three, that her practice with regard to this child violated the standard of care, and that had to do with the careful and sympathetic attention to the child's presenting complaints, past medical history, current hospital course with regard to pain, distress, ruptured family relationships, and her request for analgesic.
Sorry, Your Honor. I'm sorry to interrupt the answer. Can we approach briefly?
Sure.
More live courtroom coverage of the Take Care of Maya trial from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today is coming up. Press subscribe now.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
John Daly here. You know what day it is? Neither do I. I live life daily. That's why I only spend on Moto Casino. Moto's got daily free bonuses, daily tournaments, new slots added daily. And the best part? Guaranteed daily jackpots. You can't beat that. So today's the day you grip it and spin it with me on Moto, America's social casino. Play for free on Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino. Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Babe, did you see that Moto Casino is giving a $1,776,000 worth of prizes?
That's why they're called America's Social Casino, celebrating the birth of America bigger than anyone else.
You can win incredible experiences at NASCAR and F1 races and a grand prize of 1 million sweeps coins.
So what are you waiting for? Spin now on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's Social Casino. Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
My fellow Americans, this July, we're celebrating America's birthday at Moto Casino by giving away $1,776,000 in prizes. And one lucky winner is going to take home 1 million SC. Happy 250th birthday, America. You're welcome. Download Moto Casino today.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Hi, Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Moto Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino's the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino.